This is episode 24 of UFO Encounters. This week I'm reading from Dr. Michael P. Master's book, The Extratempestrial Model. When I have guests on my podcast, I read their books to work out questions for the episodes. And when reading these books, I find such amazing information that never makes it into the podcast. And here I get a chance to give you a peek into the book. I'll put a link to the book in the show notes. And I did seek permission to record the extract from the book, and the author kindly said yes. And so if you enjoy this podcast, please leave a review and be sure to subscribe. So I'm going to read from a section of the book called Case Study 6, 1975, Travis Walton, Arizona. And this is what Michael has written. They were a little under 5 feet in height. They had a basic humanoid form. Two legs, two arms, hands with five digits each, and a head with the normal human arrangement of features. Their bald heads were disproportionately large for their puny bodies. They had bulging, oversized craniums, a small jaw structure, and an underdeveloped appearance to their features that was almost infantile. That was a quote from Travis Walton. The Travis Walton saga began on November 5, 1975, in the Apache Sitgreaves Natural Forest near the town of Heber, Arizona. Walton was 22 years old at the time and was working on a government contract doing tree thinning on a 1,200-acre area of national forest near Turkey Springs. He was working on a six-man crew under the supervision of Mike Robbers, who had been doing contract work for the United States Forest Service over the previous 9 years. After finishing work for the day, the men piled into a pickup truck to head down the hill when they suddenly caught a glimpse of a large glowing object that looked like a flattened disc, which was hovering in the air about 100 feet from the truck. Initially, it was reported to be about 8 feet high and 20 feet wide, though in the 2017 HuffPost interview, Walton stated that it was about 40 feet in diameter. Others in the truck described it as very smooth, with a yellowish-white light that glowed brightly all around its outer edge. Because Travis Walton had a lifelong fascination with UFOs, he got out of the truck and started walking across a clearing to get a better look at it. As he approached, the UFO began to rock back and forth slightly. Then, an extremely bright blue light shot out of the bottom of the craft. It struck Walton, sent him flying back through the air, and knocked him unconscious. According to Kenneth Peterson, one of Walton's co-workers who watched from the truck, "I saw a bluish light come from the machine, and Travis went flying, like he touched a live wire." Another of Walton's co-workers, Dwayne Smith, stated, "It sure looked like he got hit by a lightning or something. I heard a zap, like as if he touched a live wire." Walton also remembers a blast of energy hitting him and a numbing shock that coursed through his body right before he lost consciousness. It is likely that Walton was struck by a strong electrostatic discharge when he approached the object. Because UAPs move through the atmosphere at incredible speed, it is logical to assume that they pick up static electricity in the process. This aspect of UFO flight was explicitly stated in one of Rorschach's encounters. When the boys asked if they could touch the ship, in her book, Montana UFOs and Extraterrestrials, Joan Bird notes that before Mike and Leo Rorschach were permitted to touch the craft, one of the visitors told his crewmates to first make sure that it was well grounded, as the ship may have picked up some electricity during its travels. Bird also cites another case from the 1950s where a man named Howard Menger was warned about the dangers of electromagnetic fields around these craft. This further denotes the high energy and static electric characteristics of these machines, as well as the potential dangers associated with getting too close to them before they have been properly discharged. Another indication that electricity played a part in what happened to Travis Walton can be seen in how the light was described by those who witnessed it from the safety of the pickup truck. Specifically, his co-workers stated that it was a tremendously bright, bluish light, which sounds a lot like a corona discharge emitted from high-voltage systems like Tesla coils. Furthermore, upon regaining consciousness, Walton expressed that he felt immense pain, like he'd been badly burned all over, even inside his body, where he described feeling as though someone had whacked him with a baseball bat. Walton is now convinced that this bolt from the ship was a static electric discharge. He is also confident it was accidental and that they were not trying to hurt him as he approached the aircraft. This is also indicated by the fact that the visitors took Walton onto the vessel to perform emergency medical procedures once they saw that he had been injured by the static discharge. So rather than an intended abduction, Walton sees this encounter as more of a spur-of-the-moment ambulance call. Regardless of their intent, Walton's fellow crew members were understandably terrified when they saw their co-worker shoot through the air after being struck by a lightning bolt ejected from the bottom of a large metal ship. Panicked, the remaining six men fled down the hill in the pickup truck. After regaining their composure, realizing they might have overreacted to the situation, and recognizing that Walton may need help, they turned the truck around and headed back up the hill. However, upon returning to the location where Walton was knocked unconscious, they found no trace of him or the mysterious disc-shaped craft that started the ordeal. After searching the woods and calling out for him repeatedly, the crewmen decided to head off into town to get help from the local police. There they met Deputy Ellison and later Sheriff Marlin Gillespie. The officers took note of the fact that these men were distressed and obviously traumatized by what they had seen. They agreed to help look for Travis Walton, and together, the officers and remaining crew members went back up the hill again. By this time, it was now dark, so after briefly searching the area with flashlights, they decided it might be better to look for Walton in the morning. After realizing that they weren't going to find him that night, around 1:30 in the morning, two of Walton's co-workers, Copland and Rogers, went to inform his mother, Mary Kellett, of her son's disappearance. Surprisingly, his mother was entirely calm about the situation, stating, "Well, that's the way these things happen." Because Travis Walton and his brother had long shared a fascination with UFOs, it didn't come as much of a surprise that her son had been taken by one. This overly relaxed response might seem strange to most, though I have a hunch that if I suddenly went missing in the presence of a UFO, my family might have a similar reaction to the situation. Over the next few days, Walton's co-workers, the police, and others continued to search the area where he had last been seen, but they found no indication of where he might have gone. Additionally, once the press got word of what had happened, the entire town of Snowflake exploded with a frenzy of reporters, ufologists, and countless others who were fascinated by the strange circumstances of Travis Walton's disappearance. Understandably, Walton remembers very little about the early stages of his abduction ambulance call, since the presumed electrostatic discharge knocked him unconscious. His first mindful memory was waking up in what he presumed to be a hospital bed. This assumption seemed logical because he was in tremendous pain, feeling as though he had been burned inside and out, and because his shirt and jacket were pushed up around his shoulders and there was a large, curved device around his abdomen. As his eyes began to focus on objects in the room, he could see three forms moving around him, which he assumed were nurses and doctors tending to him. As the blurry figures started to come into focus, however, it soon became clear that he was not in a hospital. For most abductees, the outsized and intense eyes of the visitors are often the first thing they notice and what they remember most about the experience. Walton also recalls feeling captivated but terrified by the eyes of his captors, describing them as having large luminous pupils about the size of a quarter, which were so big that part of the pupil was hidden by their eyelids. He often recalls that very little of the white part of the eye or sclera was showing, due to how large their pupils and irises were. It's remarkable how impactful the visitors' ocular characteristics are for abductees. However, This response becomes easier to understand after looking to the eyes of someone who just had their pupils dilated at the eye doctor. Okay, so this week I was reading from Dr. Michael P. Master's book, The Extratempestrial Model. If you want to buy the book, there is info and a link in the show notes. And a great way to support the podcast is to sign up on Patreon. On the Alien UFO Podcast Patreon, when you sign up for $5 a month, you get an extended episode every week. And for $2 a month, you get an extended episode every month. Just go to patreon.com/AlienUFO Podcast. And if you enjoy the podcast, please leave a review and be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or via your favourite podcast app to make sure that you don't miss out on any episodes. And thanks for listening.